begin. Give her a Sheba, front row.
Page 41. You get to guess what passage. No. Sorry. The second to the last paragraph, where it says, the Jewish soul never faces God alone.
Mm-hmm.
It says, when we stand before God, we always do so with the Torah. Not with man, is my analogy, is not with man or with man's judgment, but with the Torah. I thought that was very, very enlightening, especially with my attitude right now.
Maybe that's what that
is. Well, if we get that far, we're going to talk about some things there. We've got a lot to discuss, but if we can, we're going to get to that particular set of passages. Okay?
Ditto.
You ever talk this? You too,
she
huh?
She said the same thing.
Yeah, that was my thing too. I just really was taken by that. I really was taken by the fact that our soul doesn't have to face God alone. And it's like, oh, wow, okay. It made total sense, but I hadn't thought of it that way.
Well, there's also another way of looking at it that, okay, if you have the four different levels of hermeneutic, okay, so the first one is very literal. So if it said that Moses went to the top of the mountain, then Moses went to the top of the mountain. That's just plain, that's what he did. But if you look at it in Remez, an allegorical sense, you could say that the mountain represents government, okay? And so the mountain means government, but if Moshe is involved and he went to the top of the mountain, you understand it's the government of God, okay? So that being said, a lot of times we read certain things about, for example, this idea of judgment. So everybody, first of all, because they don't have a different perspective, they usually think of going to court. So you go to court and you face the judge, and whatever the judge determines, that's the case, okay? And it's interesting that Dr. Lesheva and I, we adopted our grandson. And how many times we go to court, Elizabeth?
22.
22 times we went to court. Not one time in those 22 times did we ever receive a bad judgment. In other words, it was never against us, it was always for us. So what I say about judgment is sometimes you have to realize that judgment is for the good, as I think it says in this one. It is, in you look in page 38, close to the bottom. The time has come for judgment to begin in the house of God. If judgment begins with us, what will the result be for those who disobey the Messiah? Okay, so you see here that there's judgment, and it can have somewhat of a negative connotation, but you have to go back to Romans chapter 8, where it is a good judgment that is received. There's no condemnation. Why? Because we do what we're supposed to do. Okay? But now, if you go further with the idea of judgment, and we get into the level of Sa'od, or the spiritual level, you don't face God with a courtroom sense. You're not standing there in the courtroom waiting for God to give you a judgment. You are there by yourself, and you do your own judging.
I was the judge.
So you understand that we are much more difficult on ourselves than it would be if we had someone to make accusations against us. Because, you know, you and I, we know every part of our life. And so we think about every part of our life, and no one knows every part of the life or all the secret thoughts. And then actually, we talked about Peshat and Remez and So'od. We can do Midrash and say that you're going to face you're going to face your guardian angel when you get there. We'll try to get into that in a minute. Okay, so very good. Anybody on the internet wish to interject anything before we move along?
Very good.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, I would like to say that the Romans, and what you said about the proselyte, that he was talking to the proselytes, and then it connected to the Torah of this week's. And I love it when a plan comes together and when the different sections, you see why they're there. You know, I just enjoyed that.
Very good, very good. It's interesting also, if you look now at the part from Luke, and this matches Mark 1 and 14 and 15, where it talks about the kingdom, the governance of God. It's through the Hachamim Bate Din. Bate means plural, houses, as opposed to human kings. When you see that verse, it's interesting because it's given us a heads up a little bit into next week's Peshat portion of text, which deals with the Hachamim, the judges. So we will be talking about the judges next week, and maybe some this week. We'll see how that works out. But you know, Aron Aviner, as much as you try, I probably spent at the first of the year, or just before, I spent week after week after week going over these pericope. These paragraphs, trying to measure them out, and then try to see if they fit with the Torah portion. And sometimes they fit so well that it's unbelievable, and other times you're thinking, where in the world is this at? And what is the connection here? And so we'll try to talk about that a little bit this evening, if we can do that at all. So very, very well said. So let's go to page 38. And we will start off with the Peshat. It says, "Beloved, do not let the fiery trial that comes on you to test you take you by surprise. It is not as though you are experiencing something strange. However, rejoice when you experience the same trials that Messiah suffered, because it reveals your nobility. If someone insults you because of of Messiah's authority, you are truly blessed. This shows that the Shekhinah, the divine presence, rests on you. As it is written, and the Shekhinah of the Lord, the presence of the Lord, will rest upon him, the Ruach of Chokhmah, Bina, and the Ruach of Da'at, all along with the Ruach of Counsel and Might, with reverential fear of the Lord." Okay, I'm going to stop right there, because the first thing that I want to talk about in this section is understanding the divine presence and realizing that the divine presence is so important to us, as you well know. But it says here in this passage that it shows that the Shekhinah rests on us. Now, at the time of the writing of Hacham Sofet's His writings, of course, being Mark, 1st and 2nd Peter, Jude, and the rest of Mark, okay? So he wrote, he's basically the author of all these pieces. So Mark, so Peter is the author of Mark, Jude, and 1st and 2nd Peter, okay? And they're all written on the simple, literal level. So when you read here that the Spirit rests on you, it means that the Spirit is wherever you are. Now, we'll try to get into that in a minute, but it says the Spirit rests on you. And the Shekhinah, divine presence again, of the Lord will rest on him. And here you would see or seem to think that it's speaking directly of a Messiah, and in a certain measure it is. But one of the things that we often do is when we say that certain things, or we attribute certain things to Messiah, we say that, well, that's good, he's Messiah, he can do all those things, and you know, I'm a man, I cannot do those things. You throw that idea in the trash can because it's not true. If the Torah and the Bible, by and large, gives an example of a man who is extremely talented or blessed or however you want to say that, then you should know that this man is not being pushed to the forefront for the sake of saying, look, you know, ha ha ha, you're not any good. Here's somebody who is really good. The reason they're pushed to the forefront in the text, specifically in the text, is for us to have a model, a role model. And we could say, because Bezalel is the one who had all of this ingenious wisdom to build the Mishkan, the tabernacle, that, you know, yes, it said that he was filled with the Ruach HaKodesh, he's filled with the Holy Spirit. Then you say, yeah, that was him. But it's not me. I'm not like that. I'm not that ingenious. But we should actually have the other view in mind. We should say, look, you know, if he could do it, so can I. And I remember the church where we were talking about the other evening. As a young man, I remembered, his name was Brother Smith, my Sunday school teacher there, Lakeview Baptist. And he was teaching us about, of course, the Hebrew children and Joseph and Daniel. And he was teaching us about all these people. And for whatever reason, in my mind, these men stood as examples of what we could achieve. I didn't think in my mind that they could achieve that because they were better than I. I thought I could achieve that because I had the same thing that they had. And I guess I was simple enough to just believe it that way because that's how I believed it. And so I've actually tried all of my life to be that way. And amazingly, I guess my attitude in life has brought me to the place that I've experienced many things, perhaps similar. I'm not on that level as they are, but nevertheless, somewhat similar. So each one of you should realize and be quite conscientious of the fact that the Shekhinah, the divine presence, rests on you. If you stop and think about that, then you say, wherever you go, the divine presence is with you. So, you should, you know, stop and think about some of the places that you're taking the divine presence. And I'm not trying to be condescending or judgmental. I'm just saying, you know, when we stop and think about the fact that the divine presence goes with us, then we should stop and consider those things. Now, there is this idea. I'm sure that everyone now is aware of the prayer that we say after we have come out of the bathroom. We don't say it in the bathroom. We say it out of the bathroom. Usually at the first mezuzah that you come to, okay? So in my house, I have mezuzot all over the place. So you come out of the bathroom, you can stand next to the mezuzah, and there you can recite your bathroom prayer. But there is an idea in Judaism that as you're about to enter the restroom, if you will, then you speak to the angels who are your guardian angels and etc. Say, just wait right here. You don't go in this room with me. This is a place that I have to go because I'm a human. Okay? And so you ask them to wait outside. And so we could say roughly the same thing about the Shekhinah, right? We ask, just wait outside for just a minute. I'll be back in just a minute. It's the way of man. Man has to conduct his business this way. So, I mean, it's interesting that the prayer that we say, the final sentence says, and he will heal all flesh. So the idea for you and I now is that we go to the restroom, and that means that something's wrong. If he's going to heal all flesh, it insinuates that we won't have to do that again. You understand what I'm saying? So that you won't have to go to the bathroom and you won't be saying this prayer, etc. When he heals all flesh, then you won't have to do that. Okay? But that means... it is disgusting. It is quite disgusting.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, but just stop and think now for a minute that, you know, all of us, I am sure, because we work so diligently to keep kosher, we're very conscientious about food, what we eat and how we eat it, etc. But keeping kosher is, as it were, the first step toward that healing of the flesh. We eat the food that we're supposed to be eating. But when we enter into the days of Messiah, we will be eating foods and we will consume their nutrition, if we could say it this way, 100%. So we'll not have to go to the bathroom because we have consumed that food and it has been consumed 100% and there's no waste product out of it. Does that make sense? Everybody understand that idea?
You're saying, like the man in the desert.
Like the man in
exactly
the desert. Exactly.
Too.
Exactly. So, you know, sirloin for the all the days of Messiah. So whatever, you know, whatever you have a craving for, you know, banana pancakes, peanut butter and bananas, whatever it is. But yes, that's very much the idea. I don't know that it will specifically say be manna in that sense, because we have visions that are that come from Revelation that say there'll be 12 different types of fruit on the tree. And they will be for the reparation or the healing of the nations. But that doesn't mean that we won't eat them. If very possible, we will. But they say in that time that the whole tree will be good for food. So
the leaves and the branches.
The leaves, the branches, the bark, everything will literally be edible. And you would not be able to determine whether you were eating the bark or the fruit. Now, we had, I think most of us here are old enough, we had a gentleman, this has been several years ago, probably a couple anyway, that he used to tell us that about all the different things that were edible, and he would find them in nature, he would find things that were edible, and he said even some parts of the pine cone are edible.
Oh, no goodness.
Yule Gibbons, any of you remember? I have yet to be that gone that far, but nevertheless. Tiny seeds.
Have seeds inside of them. They mm-hmm. really do.
Yeah. But I don't know how much the seed is worth all the effort to get in that little seed out.
No, that's for sure.
Okay. Going to page 39, I want to deal here with what we discuss here. And I think that it is fitting because I want to teach us how to deal with our place in spirituality, but in natural practicality. Okay? Starting with the first paragraph underneath the commentary, the heading commentary to Peshat and normal mysticism, the resting place of the Shekhinah. Acham Safet's refrain, this shows that the Shekhinah rests on you, and it takes to task the idea of a practical sanctity or normal mysticism. Okay. If you have been studying Judaism for any length of time, or you've even not been so much studying Judaism, but you know something about Judaism, and you hear things on the news and this and that, you will have already heard about Kabbalah. And, of course, when we talk about the four different levels, Kabbalah associates with the spiritual or the Sod. Now, let's just explain Sod in a way that makes it understandable. Sod in Hebrew means a secret. Okay, but not a secret in the sense that I know the secret and I can't tell you. It means that, especially when you are in study, like a class setting somewhat as we have now, that you hear certain things and they resonate with you or they speak to you, and you kind of have what we call an aha moment, where like, oh yeah, now I understand that. Okay? But what happens at that moment is you receive. Because Kabbalah, the word Kabbalah, means to receive. Okay, so on one level, it doesn't have to be mystical what you're receiving. You just receive. Okay? But now when we talk about Sod, it being the secret, and then Kabbalah has the idea of you have received the secret. But the thing that is secret, and the reason it is secret, is because you're the only one who knows that secret. Because no matter what I have gone through to try to give you, as it were, a revelation of this truth, when you do receive it, it's yours. It doesn't belong to anyone else. It's yours. It's your world and how you receive it. And so I could begin to talk, let's say, after the class and say, did you get my point on this or this? And then you could start to explain that point. And I said, that's not what I said. But that's what you received. And it is... is very personal and very enlightening. And herein the idea then that the Shekhinah rests on you. And that is because when the Shekhinah does come and rest on you, it is it deals with you much more than just on the individual level, but it does come down to the individual level and deal with us on an individual level.
When it says, and the Shekinah of the Lord will rest upon you, and the Ruach of Chokhmah, Bina, and Da'at, that opens up a whole... I mean, that is like, because that gives you all of the understanding, the knowledge, and the wisdom.
Absolutely. And...
So you can do far more than you give yourself credit for.
Yes.
Okay, I hear it. That's my revelation.
When the... back to page 38. When the... Shekinah rests on you, as it is written, and the Shekinah of the Lord will rest on him. It's interesting because this word rest is the same word as like Noah, Nacham. So you should understand that Nacham is associated with the idea of Shalom. Okay, these are all rooted, these words are all rooted together. So you could say, in a sense, that when the Shekinah rests on you, or when the Shekinah gives you Shalom, now you understand Shalom is not just peace. Shalom is having everything. If I can do this off the cuff. Go to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. It wasn't exactly where we're going to, but it's all right. This is why I say that we don't need hermeneutics from the place that we came from. Everybody can read between the lines, right? But we need hermeneutics, Jewish hermeneutics, if we're going to understand what the scriptures say. Go to verse 23. May the God of Shalom. And you can, what you should do is you should get your concordance out, not necessarily this minute, but you should get your concordance out and you should look at this word. Shalem is the root for shalom. Okay, shalem is the fundamental word. It means that you're perfect, you're healthy, you're whole. There's nothing wrong with you. You've been recompensed for all that is owed to you. On and on and on. There's about 15 things that you can use, or the 15 ways that you can translate the word shalom. But it all always basically means that you were whole. Complete. Okay? If you are perfect, then you're whole. You have all of your faculties. You have all of your limbs and etc. Now, it's interesting because when you answer the telephone in Israel, they say,
shalom.
And you may not know this, but when you answer the telephone here in the United States, you say shalom as well. You think I'm pulling your tzitzit fringes.
Is that what hello means?
Hello means, are you whole or do you have peace or are you complete? There is a book that is, I had to fight with, I think it was Books a Million or I don't remember which one, but I purchased the book kind of like an Amazon thing, and I purchased the book and I kept waiting for the book to arrive, and so 5-6 days, so I'd call, it wasn't Books a Million, it might have been Amazon, I don't remember. Anyway, I wanted this book. It's called How the Hebrew Language Grew. And so I wanted this book because I knew in this book it talked about this word, shalom, and the way that it should be understood. And so when I tried to purchase the book, I don't remember how it worked out, but finally, I got a hold of a young man, and I told him that, I had ordered this book. They said the book was in stock, and, that I wanted the book. And the gentleman, young gentleman, he sincerely tried to see to it that I got the book. But what happened was that particular company, whichever one it was, did not have the book. He went into Books a Million, I think it was, across the street from where he worked, and went in and purchased the book and sent me the book.
Oh, God. How funny.
Yeah, it was quite an ordeal. But this book is very enlightening. It has many things on basically the roots of the way that the Hebrew language works, so that you understand that words, for example, like shalom, have in English the idea of being hello. Or we initially say hello now, but initially we never said, to begin with, we never said hello. We said, are you whole? And this is this word, shalom. So it has the idea of being completely whole, not lacking anything, etc. So, for example, you will remember that Yosef and his brothers, Yosef is the viceroy of Mitzrayim of Egypt, and his brothers come, and he knows who they are. And now we take this to one level beyond, or three levels beyond. Mystically, he knew that his father would come to Egypt. And Yaakov knew that Yosef was alive. But Yosef asks his brother, he said, the old man that you talked about, and he's talking in a way so you don't really get the idea that they know that he's the brother. So he's kind of talking around the corner a little bit. He said, oh, the old man you were talking about, is he, in some translations we say, well, or whatever. But in Hebrew it says, shalem, is he whole? So the God of peace himself set you apart, holy. Holy has the idea of being whole, or the idea associated with shalom, because you're whole, completely 100% whole. And may your whole, same word, spirit, soul, body be preserved blameless, same idea, at the coming of our Master. Now, if we have peace, then we're whole. Now, back to page 38, I'm drifting a little bit, and I don't want to be confusing. I want to
Your Eminence?
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to interject. When I was in the union, every grievance we filed, the last sentence was, and be made whole. That was a standard phrase.
Was it? Very interesting. Very interesting. So meaning that he basically came to peace, and the only way you can have peace is if everything works the way that it's supposed to work. Okay? So you came out of the bathroom and you said that prayer because it all worked. And you realize at sometimes when it doesn't all work the correct way, how important the prayer is. Everybody with me? And the Shekinah rests upon him, the Ruach of Chokhmah, Bina, and the Ruach of the At. This is the original Kabbad. Kabbad today built on these three pillars, these three archetype structures. Okay? Now I will say this. They stole it from the Nazareans. Because this was the infrastructure of the way that the first century Synagogue worked. And I will go just a little bit farther and say that when things begin to go wrong and the Gentiles begin to take authority over the synagogues, and they quit being synagogues and they became churches, this Kabbad became severely corrupted. And I will just say that its corruption came, and a different form of Trinity developed out of it. So you can see here the basis for that Trinity, and it is so interesting because Shekhinah is not masculine. It's feminine. So you have something that's supposed to be feminine that they turned into a male. So it's interesting. Anyway. Okay. I won't go any farther than that tonight there. Okay, back to page 39. Everybody with me so far? Okay, today an overwhelming number of people are infatuated with Kabbalah. Yet all true Kabbalists will point out that there can be no Kabbalistic understanding without observing the mitzvot. So, if you find someone who refers to themselves as a Kabbalist, let's say, that person should know and be aware of the mitzvot. Now, I'll just use food as one example. Now, we can make a couple. If you consume things that are not considered food, Leviticus chapter 11, then what you do is you clog the arteries. But I'm not talking now in terms of the fact that you clog, you know, the arteries of your physical body. I'm talking about your spiritual arteries, so to speak. So you choke out true revelation knowledge, or a greater and a more in-depth knowledge, by eating things that are not acceptable. So, when you get to the place that you start to keep kosher or work towards keeping kosher, you will find generally a much clearer understanding of Scripture. But let's go beyond that and just one other point. Let's suppose that there can be no Kabbalistic understanding without observing the mitzvot. So if you never pray, then what happens? You won't receive any mystery or whatever. Does that make sense? Everybody understand? Everything has to be associated with doing something. Judaism is not a mental religion where you just think about something mentally, quote, spiritually. If you receive a, quote, intuition or intuitive idea, a revelation, however you want to say it, the idea is that it accomplishes something, or it calls you to accomplish something. Does that make sense? So if you receive a revelation that, you know what, Yeshua got up a great while before day and he went out to pray, what would that tell you? Don't roll over on the first church of the Inner Springs mattress or whatever it was. Now, I'm not being here in any way dogmatic about these. I'm just saying that you can pick out your own situation. You understand it. You know, when you find something, Hashem speaks to you, and when he speaks to you, he's not just talking to you saying, oh, you look good today, blah, blah, blah. He's talking to you because he has something that he wants you to accomplish, okay? Or something to do. And then maybe just praying and communicating with him, that's all fine. But generally, Kabbalists have the idea of what is called tikkun olam, to repair the world. So you and I are placed in a place where we have an opportunity to influence our circle. The bank you go to, the restaurant you go to, the shopping center you go to, all of these places are places where we have an opportunity to heal the world. Now, does that mean, for example, if we go to the shopping center, does that mean that you have 10 people in there and you do as we were when we were Christians, you testify to them, you give them a testimony? Is that what that means? No? What would you say that it means if we're going to do tikkun olam? And within reference to the grocery store,
acts of kindness.
Acts of kindness, absolutely. So you can be kind to the cashier, not some old grumpy old whatever. Use the self checkout so you can get violent with the self checkout. Maybe you don't realize it, but you are utilizing the store, which doesn't discriminate one way or another, for the most part, let's say it like that, about whether you're Jew or Gentile. It doesn't care if you're Jew or Gentile. But what do? You go down the aisle and you look at the product and you look for the heksher. So by just buying kosher products in a store is a certain amount of tikkun on that store. Okay. Continuing, herein we see the apprehension of the Peshat literal, practical sanctity. Practical sanctity is a mentally daunting and deep zoetic thoughts. So, whether you realize it or not, when you do acts that are spiritual actions, let's just use a simple action of washing your hands, is a very, very spiritual action. It's a deep zoetic action. And most of you have an awareness of why you wash your hands, for the most part on a spiritual level. But you don't generally, as you're standing there at the hand washing station, you don't stand there and stop and contemplate for 10 minutes the idea of washing your hands. You get there and swish wash, you wash your hands and you've said your blessing and now let's eat. But it is a very, very deep Kabbalistic idea to wash the hands. And it's very interesting that the Purushim, the Pharisees, are the ones that kind of resurrected this idea of washing the hands. They put inside of the home and inside of the household a priest just through the action of washing of the hands. So when a man washes his hands in his home, he's declaring himself to be the priest of the household. And, of course, when the woman washes her hands, she is saying, I'm the priestess. Or, one I like as much or more is she's the Sheth Kael. She is the woman of valor. Take, for example, the Kiryat Shema, the recital of the Shema. When we stop to realize that God has given us a simple concept to meditate on and recite, we see even its practical application is as deep as any Kabbalistic thought. His Eminence has taught you that we recite the Shema. And, of course, those who know anything about the oral Torah and the literature that we read, that is the Masorah, you know that in the opening chapters of the Mishnah, it talks about recital of the evening Shema. Now, it seems very interesting that he should talk about the evening Shema, but that's because it's based on the fact that it was evening and it was morning the first day. Okay? So the day starts when? We're already in tomorrow. Yeah, we're already tomorrow. Now, when you recite this evening Shema, it is a form of tikkun for the world that we live in right now. It is specifically designed for exile, being in exile, which we're in exile right now. We're not in Israel, and etc. And that needs a lot of unpacking, but we will just leave it at that for the present. But the Nazareans knew that we were going to go into exile. I read a few weeks ago now the idea that you you know that some of us were chosen to live in diaspora. Now listen to what Yaakov says, James says. Yaakov, a dolos, which means a courtier of God, and of our Master Yeshua HaMashiach to the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad. So we're in diaspora, and he understood the diaspora, and the evening always represents diaspora, and the Shema recited in the evening is a tikkun for diaspora. So, of course, what we just read from Chaim Yaakov is that he said, to all the 12 tribes that are in diaspora, was the insinuation of that verse. Doesn't it insinuate that he knew where the 12 tribes were? Mm-hmm. Now, listen to this line again. It said, when we stop to realize that God has given us a simple concept to meditate on and recite, it is said that if you were to linger long on the word Echad, you would cease to be.
I tried it. I guess I don't linger long enough. I'm just kidding.
And we're talking about achieving a certain spiritual level too, right?
Yeah, that's true. Most definitely.
Okay, so we don't sometimes stop and think about the magnitude of our simple prayers, what they do accomplish, what they don't accomplish, etc. But by and large, what they do is, as we say further on, prayers and the way they're constructed are set in a way so that they draw close the divine presence. So, for example, you go to the restroom, you tell the angels, please wait here, this is the way of humans, and you return. And what do you want? You want them to return to you. You don't want them to have gone home. You want them to stay there and wait for you. And then what you want is you want them to return, so you say a prayer. Right? Thank you because my body is working correctly, etc. Right? So this prayer causes them to return. Going down a line or two, Kiryat Shema is a Peshat obligation, embraces deep responsibilities. For example, the yoke of the kingdom. So this means here the idea of the yoke of the kingdom is to accept the governance of God. But that is established for us on page 38, and it says, and again I said to you that I will compare the kingdom governance of God, sovereignty of God, through the Hakamim, excuse me, and Batidin, as opposed to human kings. Now, I'll start to wrap up here and say, that many aspects of our life are done quite mechanically. And we basically go through life so mechanically that we fail to acknowledge the fact that God has done something extraordinary . Go to page 43. Where it says Midrash Rabbah Breshi 10:6. The son of Sirah said, God caused drugs to spring forth from the earth. With the physician heals the wound, and the apothecary compounds his preparations. Rabbi Shimon said, there's not one single herb or blade of grass that has a constellation or a moloch in the heavens which strikes it and says to grow. So what it is saying is, every blade of grass that you see, every tree, every leaf on the tree has an angel that strikes it, so to speak. The striking means he's encouraging it to grow, causing it to grow. Now, suppose you looked into the dimension of the spiritual world. Note, right below that, note that the earth is agitated by a malach, an angel, that causes it to grow. Please take note that the vegetable animal kingdom has a governing mazel or constellation or an angel. So we look into the cosmos, and we look into the cosmos or the galaxy, and we try to figure out how come there are orange giants, this dwarf, that gaseous anomaly, etc., etc., etc. We have no understanding of how those things affect our little world. And while it is not necessarily outside the realm of the possible to say that there is another planet like this in our galaxy, but basically, I don't care. My point is that all of the things in our cosmos are affecting this world that we're in right now. I will conclude with an idea now that this naturally should lead to as you follow the next couple of paragraphs. And I will start with the final words of the paragraph at the bottom of page 43 to the top of 44. The heavenly beings are in general knowledge of some Jewish scholars believed to be the Moloch that speaks with us in the womb, and it is the Malach Shomer, or the guardian angel. Many scholars believe the Malach Shomer should be equated with Irin, that is a specific group of angels called watchers. You can find that in Daniel 4:10, or 4:14, or 4:20, etc. That's another discussion. But here is the question and the idea about the Malach Shomer. The Malach Shomer is with you much like the Shekinah that rests on you, you have also not just the Shekinah resting on you, but you also have a Malek Shomer, a guardian angel. Now, I will surmise this quickly and say that most of us think that the job of the Malek Shomer is to guard us and keep us from, as I said in the paragraph there, from being run over by a truck. But people do get run over by trucks. So does that mean that the Malek Shomer is not doing its job? I told you, you were supposed to watch out for those trucks. Now, I will say it like this because perhaps you're not well associated with the idea, but there is a idea of Shomer Shabbat, which basically means to guard the Sabbath. So the idea of guarding the Sabbath means that you do the things on Shabbat that you're supposed to do. You say some prayers, you study the Torah, you have a Sabbath meal, etc. So, Shomer Shabbat has come to mean that the people who are Shomer Shabbat are very meticulous about their Torah observance in life. Okay? We're supposed to get up in the morning and recite a prayer, and we recite the prayer. We're supposed to do certain things throughout the day, we do that. So now when we transfer that idea of Shomer to the Malek, what do you get?
He's a guardian angel.
He's a guardian angel, but how is he guarding? What is he guarding? He's guarding the Torah that he gave you when you were in your mother's womb. And so, every day when he speaks to you, he's telling you, BLTs are not on the menu. And no, you cannot have a cheeseburger either.
Come on, man.
I gave the secret away this evening.
Yes, you did.
And I'll tell you how to work around it. If you want a cheeseburger, it's very simple. Just get an avocado, a nice ripened avocado, and slice it thinly and put it on the hamburger, and you'll never know the difference. Mm-hmm, me too. Okay, so what I'm trying to say is that the Shomer, the Malek Shomer, this guardian angel, is an angel that guards the Torah that he gave you when you were in your mother's womb. And from time to time, he also has another title. And that title is the title of a Magid. M-A-G-G-I-D. Magid. And a Magid is a storyteller or a teller. Someone who tells. Everybody knows in the Pesach Seder, and during the Pesach Seder, there's a Magid, right? There's a place where we tell the story. Now, I'll say it like this, but it's always very controversial. People worry about it, and they don't need to worry about it. But that is that many of the truly deep sages that are extremely spiritual, one that comes to mind for me, one of my personal favorites is Luzzatto, Derek Hashim, one of the most profound books that you'll ever read. When he was asked, you know, how he came up with these deep spiritual ideas, he said he had a Magid. And so when he told them he had a Magid, because he was an astute Torah scholar beyond a Kabbalah before he was 12, 13 years old. He was an amazing, amazing person. And he said that he had a Magid, and that caused everyone to be in panic and question his writings and his authority. Because it's saying, I had a messenger, I had someone who spoke to me and taught me many of these things. So can we determine that the action is right or wrong? The revelation of Yeshua HaMashiach, which God gave to him, to Yeshua, to show his servants, God's servants, things that must shortly take place. And he sent, and he put them in symbols by his messenger to his messenger, John. Did John have a Magid?
Yes.
And the whole entire book of Revelation is based on the fact that he had a Magid that was telling him secrets that we now refer to as the revelation. And I will stop here. Hopefully I did not confound you more. We illuminated more than we confounded. But, you know, you always have to bait the fish. Right? You put the bait and the bait in the worm. Fish sees the worm and he says, now, next Wednesday evening will be Rosh Hashanah. And I would say, personally, I'd like to go ahead and have class. But that will depend on you. If you want to have class, we'll have class. If you do not want to have class, I understand. But I will be ready to give a class next week and prepare us for the following day, which will be Rosh Hashanah. And we will be speaking along the lines of what was laid down by Shaul and the Tosefta this week, and it will be with regards to the Hachamim. Now I'm going to take and I'm going to tell you now one little piece so you can understand some of what we will be talking of. There's a lot of things that are in that particular commentary, which you should already have now. But one of the things I will be talking about is your guardian angel. Oh, we just did that. But I didn't give you the whole story. And so next week we'll unravel the rest of the truth. So.